Hi, I'm Daryl Jones, Director of Research at Hedgeye, an independent investment research firm focused exclusively on generating thoughtful investment ideas for institutional money managers. President Theodore Roosevelt once said, "The credit belongs to the man in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at best knows the thrills of high achievement, and if he fails, at least fails daring greatly so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat." You've likely heard the quote before, but we embrace Teddy's words as we grind daily to produce research that finds the truth in the markets, not just echoing the lazy or consensus narrative. We don't pretend to be the smartest guys in the room, and we make our share of mistakes, but we love the debate and the opportunity to help our clients play this most interesting and challenging game at the highest level. It is our worthy cause. This podcast will give you a glimpse inside our locker room to get to know our team, our failures, our wins, and most importantly, our investment process. Welcome to Hedgeye in the Arena. Welcome to the 20th episode of Hedgeye in the Arena. I'm Daryl Jones, and I'm pleased to introduce Joe Calhoun, owner, CEO at Alhambra Investment Partners. Joe, you have an incredible background, so it would be great, I think, for our listeners if you could take a few minutes and just give them some context about sort of where you came from and how you ended up starting your own firm.
Sure. Thanks for having me on today, Daryl. Yeah, I don't have a traditional background here. I come from quite a different world. I'm an engineer by training. I'm a Gamecock, University of South Carolina. And after college, I spent 8 years in the Navy on submarines operating nuclear reactors. And it was a very interesting time for sure. It's one of those things where at the time you're in it doesn't feel so great, but when you look back on it, it was a great time. I did that for 8 years, and I was on a ballistic missile sub out of Scotland. I did a bunch of patrols up there playing cat and mouse with the Russians. This was back in the 80s. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it, but I got out, and in 1990, I left. I had been on shore duty, and my daughter was born in 90, and I was scheduled to rotate back to shore duty and to sea duty. I would have been assigned to a submarine out of probably the West Coast. I would have been gone 6-7 months out of the year for her first 4 or 5 years of life, and I felt like that wasn't a great way to be a father. So
right.
I decided to resign and got out. I worked for about a year as an engineer for Staub Brown, a very big ABB, big European engineering firm, and
yep.
I absolutely hated it. So I had always been in the market. I'd made some money through the 80s, and I decided I wanted to be in this business. And the only place that would hire me was Dean Witter.
So you started in a very, I guess, retail place in many ways.
Well, at the time, more than the term retail is applied to this business, because at the time, Dean Witter was owned by Sears.
Right.
And they also owned Allstate. So we used to jokingly refer to it as stocks and socks. My first 6 months, I actually sat in a booth at a Sears store selling Dean Witter mutual funds. So I think I've probably, I've traveled a long path to get here, put it that way.
Right. So you start your financial career at Dean Witter, then what was the next move you took after that?
I worked there for a few years. All they really wanted me to do was push their mutual funds, which were not that great to begin with. So I moved from there to Prudential, which was kind of like jumping from the fat to the fire. Dean Witter had lousy mutual funds. Prudential had lousy partnerships from the 80s. And so it's one of those things. But whatever. I decided I wanted to. I'd been kind of a stock jock, but I really loved the options market. That was kind of my first love.
Right.
And so I started an option trading business for geared primarily towards hedge funds. And I did that for rest of my career. I started that business at Pru, and then in 96 I took it to Oppenheimer and Company and stayed there until 2006 when I started this firm.
Gotcha. So you know, one interesting thing you told us before coming on is that I guess while you're on submarine duty, you actually did, I think, very well in the crash of 87. How did that all come about? Like, how did you get yourself, you know, at that point you're not a financial professional, but you've obviously educated yourself, but how did you get so well positioned ahead of the crash, and you know, what exactly did you do to make money?
Well, luck. When you're on a submarine, you have a lot of spare time. We would spend on a ballistic missile sub, you go down and you spend 70 days underwater. And it is, I was on a ballistic missile sub. Our only mission was to be a launch platform in the North Atlantic. So we used to do what was called four knots to nowhere. You went in a circle, or actually a square, for 70 days underwater, and it's pretty boring.
Right.
And now I will say, punctuated by moments of sheer terror, but but it was generally pretty boring. But I spent all that time reading about the markets and reading about economics. And when I was on shore duty in 87, I was actually in Bremerton, Washington, and we were overhauling a submarine, and I had been back then, spent a lot of time in the library researching options trading and so forth. So I was actually, I look back on it now, and it's kind of funny, actually, because essentially what I was running was a black swan type strategy where I was buying out-of-the-money puts and calls. So 87 comes along, the crash in 87. I remember I had a lot of, it was just blue-chip stocks. Again, out-of-the-money puts mostly, but a few calls, too. I remember Friday before the crash, we were down 150 points on the Dow, which at the time was a significant number. And I remember my broker called me, and he's like, "Do you want to sell?" And I was like, "Nah, let's let it ride." So Monday, I came off of the midnight shift. I had been supervising a fuel rod replacement on a reactor. I come off, and I called my broker. I'm on the West Coast, so it's like 8, 9 o'clock in the morning. And I called him, and he was just in a panic. "Oh, my God, the market's crashing, the market's crashing." And I said, "Well, where are my options?" He said, "I have no idea." And he said, "You know, the quotes are so delayed, I really don't know, but you're up a bunch." He said, "Do you want to sell?" And I said, "Nah, let's let it go for a while." I finally sold about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and I made more that day in the option market than I did the entire year from the Navy.
Oh, wow.
So it was a good day.
That's great. I mean, obviously not many people, especially that would be buying mutual funds and Sears stores, would have had that kind of day on the big crash.
No, it was pretty unique. Of course, you know, I look back on it now, and it was sheer luck. You know, black swan strategies are interesting, I suppose, but it's a whole bunch of losing, you know, and then hopefully you hit a big one, and which I did in this case.
Yeah.
It took me about 6 months. I gave about half of that gain back before I stopped trading and said I need to reassess.
Right.
So.
Okay. So fast forwarding. Well, first of all, you know, as I was kind of researching for this interview, I thought how you came up with the name of your firm was kind of unique and a great story. Maybe you could give a little background on, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, but is it Alhambra?
It depends on where you're from.
I'm from Canada.
If you're a redneck like me, it's Alhambra. If you're, you know, Spanish, it's Alhambra. So it just depends on where you're from. But however people say it, just, you know, call us.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm not sure what story you read about how the name came about, but I'm going to give you the true story here.
Okay, sounds good.
The marketing story that's on the website is very interesting about how, you know, there's all this permanence. You know, the Alhambra has been there since 1492, and, you know, it represents this permanence and this stability that we want to project. And the reality is that I started this company. I was in Coral Gables, Florida, a suburb of Miami, and it has a Moorish theme. The guy that George Merrick, who built Coral Gables back in the 20s, gave it a Moorish theme. Why he did, I have no idea, but he did. Anyway, I was sitting in my attorney's office. We were doing the paperwork to start the company. And he said, "What are you going to call it?" And I said, "Well, I have no idea." And he said, "Well, think about it for a minute." And I looked out the window, and there was a street sign there, and it said Alhambra Circle. And so I turned to him, and I said, "We're going to call it Alhambra." So there's a wonderful marketing story on the website.
Right.
And it's marketing, which is I think calculated lying.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, that's the real story, is that I had no idea what I was going to call it, and we called it Alhambra because that's the street I was on.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, it is a great marketing story, I got to say, and also a great origin story too.
It is. I've been to the Alhambra. It is a beautiful place.
So, you know, I'm curious, what made you decide to go out on your own? Like, what sort of need did you see in the market that kind of compelled you? Because obviously, you know, it sounds like you had a great career going, you know, had a pretty good run, I'm sure, trading, you know, trading options and working with hedge funds. But at some point, you must have had a, you know, quote-unquote come to Jesus moment where you decided you wanted to go out on your own, you saw a need in the market. But how did that come about, and what was the need that you saw?
I might term it more come to Buddha, but whatever.
Yeah, come to Buddha, yeah.
Look, I started that business in 96. I had really one hedge fund client. That was all I had. And it was an interesting business. Remember, I was a broker. I was on the brokerage side of this thing. So I'm a trader. I'm making money off the trades or making a commission, whatever, you know, however it was structured. I started that business, and, you know, our typical trade would be 25 to 50 contracts. It was a decent business, but it wasn't very big. Over the next 10 years, I built it up. I had 15 hedge funds. Our typical trades were 1,000, 1,500 contracts. It was quite a big business. But, you know, the margins got squeezed by the electronic trading.
Yeah.
The value of someone providing you with advice about what to do about a position, whatever, became degraded because of essentially the change in price was so great on commissions and markups and so forth that the business really wasn't economic anymore. I would also say, too, there's no loyalty in the hedge fund business. You're as good as your last trade, and if you're on a roll, then you're going to make a lot of money, and if you're not on a roll, nobody answers your calls.
Right.
And I didn't like that. I had a small private client business, a small group of people, family, friends, people that have been referred to me, but I never really concentrated on that business. But 2006, I'm thinking about, you know, what am I going to do here? Because I got to do something. I don't want to keep doing what I'm doing. I'm working twice as hard and making half the money. And when I got to thinking about it, the most satisfying thing really was working with those individuals. And I always think about this one guy, Richard. Richard came to me in the early 90s. And listen, like I said, I was a stock jock. Look, and it was a great time to be a stock jock in the 90s. I was an engineer. I understood computer networking. I understood a lot of the technology stocks, so that's where I concentrated. We made a ton of money in the 90s. It was just, you know, you just had to have some clue about what you were doing technology-wise, and you'd make a lot of money. But anyway, this guy came to me in the early 90s. He had been divorced. He was a plumber. And he had to sell the plumbing company to pay off the wife. And he was working as a building inspector for Manchester, New Hampshire Building Department. And he called me. It was a referral from my dad. And he called me, and he says, I don't know how I'm ever going to retire. He was in his 50s at the time. He said, I don't know. And I said, look, you know, there's a partnership here. You do what you got to do, which is, you know, make as much money as you can and save as much as you can. And I'll do my part, which is the investing side. And we did. But come 1990 now, 2000, he wants to retire. And he said, Joe, this is great. We made a ton of money, but I got to have some stability. And so we did. We came up with an asset allocation plan. We came up with a strategic allocation that we still use today. And I actually developed what we do as a firm. It came from this one client. So I took this guy from I don't know how the hell I'm going to retire to comfortably retired, living, you know, on the coast in New Hampshire in a house that's paid for with, you know, a seven-figure portfolio.
Yep.
And that, to me, is why we do this. You do it to help people.
Yep.
He didn't know anything about the market. And it's a very, very satisfying thing when you can look back on that now 30-year, almost 30-year relationship with that guy.
So, yeah, I guess, you know, the reward to you is just being able to help these individuals save for the future, build their wealth, and also have a comfortable life when they do decide to retire.
Yeah, like I said, it's just a very satisfying thing. And, you know, our job is difficult, I suppose. It's always difficult, but I think it's something that can be very satisfying if you do it right.
Yeah.
And I think that you know, I know it sounds hokey, you know, we're in this business to help people, but that's really what we're here for. You know, people are their own worst enemy, and I think a lot of times they need someone to make sure that they're not making the mistakes that everybody makes.
Yep.
And then, that's what we do.
When you sent us some notes through for the interview, you also, I guess, mentioned another client, and I think you referred to him as having the investor Stockholm syndrome. But, you know, effectively, it was somebody that had been talked into having this massive life insurance policy, you know, paying $250,000 a year in premiums. Tell me about what happened there. Like when you had your first conversation with him, how he got into this situation, and you know how you dealt with it.
Yeah, that's sort of the recent thing, and I think what bugs me about it, and the reason I told you about it, the reason I like to talk about it, is that here we are in 2019, and there are still some bad actors in our business. And I suppose anytime there's a lot of money to be made, there's going to be bad actors. But it is very, very distressing to me still dealing with this stuff. So this guy comes to us. He actually came to one of my sales guys up in Parkland, the country club up in Parkland. He comes to him, and he kind of knew who he was and said, "Hey, I've got this guy trying to sell me a life insurance policy, and I would you mind taking a look at what I got here and what he's trying to sell me and see if this makes sense?" He said, "Because I feel like I think I've got enough life insurance." And so our guy Chris said, "Well, give us all the information about what you have now and what he's trying to sell you, and we'll take a look at it." So the guy sends all this stuff over, and he's got a nice portfolio. And this guy, he makes good money. He makes $1 million a year. He runs a business. It's not rocket science, but it's a good business. There's some questions maybe about how long it's going to last. He's in a very, very specific field, and I question, and he does too, how long it's going to last. But for right now, he's making $1 million a year. He's having a great time. But we look at this portfolio. So he's got a nice portfolio, a couple of $1 million, 2.5, whatever it was, but then he's got all this life insurance. Start looking at it, and it is ultimately this life insurance agent, and he works for a very well-known company. I won't say who it is, but certainly you would know the name. He has sold this guy $23.5 million of face value life insurance. Now, this guy's net worth is maybe $5 million. Wow. There's absolutely no reason he needs $23.5 million worth of life insurance. He even sold him what's known as the second-to-die policy for $5 million face value. Now, second-to-die policies are generally used as estate planning tools, and they would be used if both of the husband and the wife die, and now you got the kids, and this policy would be used to pay estate taxes. Except this guy's estate doesn't even qualify for estate taxes. In fact, it's not even close. And a $5 million policy, it would imply that this guy needs to have a net worth in the $35 to $40 million range when he's actually got a net worth of five.
Right.
And the only reason he got sold this stuff was because the insurance agent wanted to make a commission. And I don't think many people know how much these commissions can be. A typical life insurance policy, a whole life policy, as much as 70 or 80% of that first year premium is going directly in the agent's pocket. So it's a big number. If you sell a guy a policy with a $250,000 first year premium, this guy's going to put six figures in his pocket.
Right.
Not small. And so I think what's most distressing about this whole thing, though, is we go through this thing, we show this guy, look, he sold you these variable universal life policies, for instance, and they've got these horrendous expenses, 2, 3, 4% a year, depending on how it's structured. There's just gigantic expenses in these things. We start talking to this guy, and what's most amazing to me is he continues to defend this guy, this agent. This agent is a lifelong friend of this guy, and he's like, "Oh, he wouldn't do that to me." I said, "No, he did do that to you." Now, we've gotten the guy to move a little bit. He has opened an account with us, and we're starting to move, but he is still very reluctant to believe that this insurance agent has done him wrong. And I find that very distressing. Like you said, we call it, and actually, I'll give credit where credit's due. This was my wife's idea. She said it, that's like Stockholm syndrome.
Right.
Where a captive is identifying with their captor.
Yeah.
Where a kidnapped victim is identifying with the captor. And I think it's the same kind of thing. It's just psychology. It's very difficult, I think, when you've got that much invested in this guy and in these policies, to admit that you've been screwed over. But you got to do it. You got to move on.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And those are two really interesting examples. I guess one of where you really help somebody, and another where you're potentially helping somebody that got swindled a little bit unwind things, which is important as well. Kind of flipping over to what's going on in the markets now. The one thing that everybody's sort of talking about is the yield curve. Well, at least people that look at all markets are talking about is the yield curve. Be curious, based on your experience, what your view of what's happening in the yield curve is now, and what kind of an indicator do you think it actually is? Obviously, everybody likes to say that it's a precursor to a recession, but what are your thoughts on what's going on in the Treasury market and what the implications of it are?
Well, you know, first of all, we do use the yield curve as part of our macro side work. And we've been doing this for a very long time. Jeff Snyder does a lot of our economic research. Jeff and I work very closely together. And it is part of what we do. It's part of what we look at. It always has been since we started this firm. But I will say, you know, I've been in this business a long time, close to 30 years. And I think I said in the email, talked about it. When I got in this business, I don't remember anybody talking about the yield curve. Nobody knew what it was. I always joke that if you called Benny on the equity desk and asked him about a yield curve, he's going to be like, yeah, you need to talk to the bond nerds because I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
So the yield curve now, I think, is obviously well known. And I'll tell you a story. Listen, I'm a Southerner, so you get stories with me, man. That's what you're going to get.
Yeah, that's great. We like it.
So one of my partners here at Alhambra, Marcelo Perez, bought a house down here, an older home, a couple of years ago, whatever it was. A house built in the 60s. So he had a door needed replaced. And so he measures the thing out, and it's an odd size. Can't just go down to Home Depot and get this thing. So he calls up this door manufacturer. They send a guy out to measure for the door. And he sees Marcelo works from home sometimes. He has a computer open. He sees he's looking at the stock market. So he asks him, hey, you know, you're in the market, huh? What do you do? So Marcelo tells him, and the guy starts talking about, oh, I'm in this Twitter group, and yeah, we're in the market, and so forth. So fine, okay, it's no big deal. I mean, you know, everybody's in the market to some degree, I suppose. But he comes back to install the door, and he sees Marcelo again looking at the market and so forth, and he says, hey, you heard about this yield curve thing, right? And Marcelo said, well, yeah, he said, you know, what do you think it means? And the guy said, oh, well, you know, recession's coming. You know, you need to sell your stocks and buy bonds because recession's coming. It works perfectly. It always works. You got to get out. Now, as you know, I'm sure there is a story from the 1920s. Infamously, Joe Kennedy supposedly sold all of his stocks when the shoeshine boy was giving him stock tips in 1929.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I don't think this is exactly the same thing. But I got to tell you, if the guy hanging doors knows about the yield curve, I'm going to guess it may not have the same level of importance that it once did. Nothing against door installers or door manufacturers, by the way, because we live in South Florida where, you know, you get a hurricane, you better be sure your door's done right. And I'll tell you, I do a lot of home improvement stuff. I love working around the house, and hanging the door is not an easy thing to do. But I don't know that I want to take his advice on the yield curve.
Right, exactly. You know, so sort of as a second question on that topic, you know, negative nominal bond yields around the world, I mean, this is sort of a new phenomenon. What do you guys make of that and sort of the implications? I mean, we're really in a very strange new world versus kind of any period we've seen in economic history.
Yeah, I think it is very strange. You know, look, Jeff Snyder on our team does a lot of work on money markets, euro dollars, euro dollar futures, and so forth. I think with the yield curve and just bonds in general, I think that, you know, first of all, I think there's a lot of yield curves. Everybody last week was concentrating on this 10-2 curve, but the 10-year, 3-month curve has been inverted since May. So, you know, but does it still mean the same thing it has in the past? And I would say, too, you know, I think there's a question here of whether an inverted yield curve causes recession or whether it's just an indication, and if it is an indication, what exactly does it mean?
Yeah.
But to the bigger question, you know, about these negative bond yields, look, I don't know what it means. And I think there's a way too much in our business. We always want to come up and say, hey, I know what this means. I have an answer. I got to tell you, I really don't have an answer. I think that when we look at what's going on in Europe, obviously, I think that the takeaway here is not what does it mean, but has it worked?
Right.
And I think it really hasn't. I mean, if you look at what's going on in Europe, I mean, really, it's about bank balance sheet capacity to some degree. You think about what they're doing here. They're using their bank balance sheet capacity to front run the ECB. They're not out there lending to businesses. They're not doing what they need to do to expand the economy. They're just playing an economic or a financial game with the ECB. So I don't think that it's working. And I think that one of the things that is just is just strange right now. I listen to people talking about the market. I see things on CNBC, for instance, and you know the people are talking about things like they're normal. And they talk about earnings season. Oh, well, you know, earnings are doing X, and you know, we're, of course, companies are beating their estimates and all these things. And it's just like everything is normal, but it's not. You know, I mean, negative bond yields, as far as I know, negative nominal bond yields have never happened in the history of the world. So it's a very strange place we reside in right now, and I'm not sure that anybody really knows what it means or what the implications are. I will say this. I think I generally am not of the opinion that central banks have as much power as people think they do. I think they have the power to move trading desks to do certain things maybe are in the trading desk's best interest or the bank they work for in their best interest, but maybe not in the best interest of the economy or society as a whole. But in general, I think markets do what they do. Yeah. And if you've got really low negative or really low bond yields, I think there's a reason for that.
I think that's absolutely spot on. I think I was reading a recent post on your website, but you know, you guys talked a little about one of your colleagues wrote about the theatrics of central bankers as well, which, you know, in many instances probably do more harm than good. And you know, I think that's one of the challenges we face as investors now, just, you know, trying to read these theatrics and the reality is that, you know, maybe the Fed can't do or the ECB can't do as much as they try to act like they can do.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting that we're having this big debate now about whether the Fed should cut a quarter point or 50 basis points next meeting. I got to tell you, if the difference between contraction and expansion in this economy is 25 or 50 basis points on the Fed funds rate, I think we got bigger problems.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yes. So another topic that, you know, people have been dealing with for, I guess, almost 3 years now is the Trump presidency. And, you know, obviously the market can be, and this isn't a political comment at all, but the market can be impacted, you know, by his tweets almost on a daily basis, it seems like. You know, we tend to look at that as more noise than anything, although it does have real impact, but, you know, especially on the policy side. But I'd be curious, you know, how you guys deal with this kind of new phenomenon of a president that's on Twitter that's doing things that, you know, at a bare minimum impact the markets, you know, if not the economy. You know, how do you try to deal with what you're seeing from Trump on, you know, a daily or weekly basis?
Well, first, I would agree that the situation you have to deal with, and I would also agree that it's mostly noise. But the president does have the ability to change policy in certain ways, and certainly the ability to influence policy. And so I think there is an element that is more permanent than we wish. And I would just say, too, that it's difficult sometimes to know how long, if he tweets something or says something or there's an impression about him, how long is the effect going to last? And I think that's something that's very difficult to deal with. And I think that the greatest example is you go back and you look after he was elected. And by the way, not to break my arm patting myself on the back, I predicted he was going to get elected. I also predicted that the market was going up if it did, because he was, you know, advocating a pretty standard Republican tax cut package, and the market was going to like that.
Yeah.
And so it did. But I have to say, you know, you go back and look at that move in the dollar, just as an example, and the move in bonds that we got right after the election, it was extreme. And I expected, I wrote about it at the time, I said, look, you know, the thing to worry about here, you're going to get some kind of tax package, and that's going to have a positive impact on the economy, at least in the short term. You know, does it last? Well, the time will tell. The only thing that we could see that potentially had potential to change things long term was if you got a surge in investment from the tax cut that translated into productivity growth, then you could see a change in the underlying growth trend. But absent that, quite frankly, what we said all last year was we're going to fall back to trend. And Jeff Snyder, again, the money markets are extremely important to us because they give us an early warning. We saw things happen in the euro dollar market over a year ago that said the slowdown was coming, and it did.
Yeah.
But to us, it wasn't really a surprise. But what I mean, though, is that if you look at that time frame from the election and how long the dollar stayed up and how, you know, we went to 3.25 on the 10-year, that whole optimism there, it lasted a lot longer than we expected, I have to say.
Yep.
Because my fear from the very beginning, my biggest fear was trade. And it was kind of strange because his first year in office, he kind of talked about it, but it wasn't really a focus, obviously. But then starting last year, it started to be a focus and it started to be a big problem for the market.
Yep. No, that's exactly right. What do you, you know, again, this isn't intended to be a political question, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on immigration policy and, you know, its potential to impact U.S. growth one way or the other.
Well, look, I mean, I'm of the, you know, kind of old school here where, you know, economic growth is about workforce growth and productivity growth. That's really all it's about. So obviously the workforce piece of that equation is affected by immigration.
Right.
Look, I don't like talking politics either because to me, and I'll just tell you, look, I'm a lapsed Republican, I suppose. I'm not a member of any party at this point. I don't like politics anymore. I've become kind of disgusted with it, as I think a lot of Americans have. And I think that when you look at immigration, it's a perfect example of why we're so disgusted. It's like we're at these extremes where we have one side that basically says let everybody in and the other side that says don't let anybody in.
Right.
And I think the vast majority of Americans would say, you know, we need to land somewhere in the middle there.
Yep.
But I will say, look, these problems are hard to solve, man. You know, think about immigration for a second. And I've heard some intimations from the Trump administration about you know, they want higher quality, educated with money and so forth. And you look at other countries, they have these programs where if you invest a certain amount of money, you're able to come in the country. I know Canada has a program like that.
Yep.
I gotta say, I think we got to be really careful about stuff like that. You know, some of the most successful people in the history of this country came here with nothing in their pocket,
right,
with no education whatsoever. I don't think we want to lock that out. I live here in Miami where, you know, we've got a huge immigrant community from all over Latin America, but the biggest group, obviously, is Cuban Americans.
Yep.
And we've seen some just huge, people came here with nothing. They came on a plane from Havana in 1960. They came here with nothing. And they have been able to build this life here, scratching and scraping and getting it done. Look, a lot of them didn't have education, or if they had an education, you know, a doctor or an engineer or something, it was from a university that wasn't recognized here. So they had to start over.
Yep.
And they had to do to succeed, and it worked. So, you know, I think we got to be really careful about that. But I think when you look at the policies of this administration, you've got immigration policy, which is bad for workforce growth, bad for population growth. And we've got these tariffs, which I think are bad on the investment side, which means it's bad for productivity growth. So I don't see a lot of good things in this administration. I'm not a big fan. But I will say, too, I am extremely impressed and continue to be impressed by the resiliency of the U.S. economy.
Yeah,
it's pretty amazing.
I was going to ask you about that. You know, despite all these issues, what are your thoughts on the U.S. economy? Because I think even for us, it's been more resilient than we expected.
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting things going on here. I'll pick one example that I think most people are not concentrating on. Look, I think there's a new emphasis in the United States on frugality. And you see that in things like the savings rate. But you also see it in this proliferation of sites where people buy and sell used clothing and things like that.
Yep.
Frugal is kind of a hot thing again. Maybe that was our parents or grandparents, I suppose. But you look at the savings rate, and something happened in mid-2005, and the savings rate just did a V. We had been falling since the early, late 70s, mid-70s, actually. I think the savings rate peaked in 1975 or 76, or around there. Well into double digits, you know, a 15% savings rate, something along those lines. And we had fallen all the way to 2.2% by July of 2005. And since then, it's just been a V, and we've been trending up since then. So we've gone from 2.2 in 2005 to an 8.1% savings rate now. Now, look, I think that has an impact on the economy and the growth rate, and maybe that's part of secular stagnation or part of the new normal or whatever you want to call it. But ultimately, investment comes from savings. So you got to have the savings piece in order to get the investment.
Right.
And I think, too, that savings, yes, a lot of it's been offset by government deficits and so forth. But ultimately, that's what's going to determine the value of the dollar, and it's going to determine to a large degree our trade and current account deficits too. So I think that's the piece of the puzzle that people haven't really concentrated on. But just in general, I just think, you know, I'm an optimist. I always have been. I think that people want to succeed. They want to do the things that they want to do in their life. They want to raise their kids. They want to send them off to college so they can be better than we were. And I think the power of that is pretty incredible. And Americans are a resilient people. We get things done. That's what we've always done.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So I'm curious, you know, kind of as we wrap up here, what, you know, either assets or stocks or asset classes you're favorably disposed to now versus, you know, areas that you'd be selling or shorting. I don't know if you guys short, but sort of what do you like now and what do you dislike?
Well, we don't do any shorting. Look, we run long-term strategic portfolios. We have a strategic asset allocation that we stick to, and then we make tactical changes. We really are pretty much in our strategic model at this point. We're not really making any big changes. We don't think we're at recession time yet, despite the yield curve. We don't think we're there. You know, credit spreads have been well-behaved. We generally pay a lot of attention to credit markets rather than just the treasury market.
Yep.
We don't see a lot of stress there, so we're not too concerned about that. But listen, we're value guys. Listen, I've been doing this for a long time. I'm a value guy. This is who I am. And I think value investors, growth investors, momentum guys, I think you're born. I'm not sure you're made. I think you are who you are. I was raised mostly by my grandmother, who was a depression person. So, I mean, she knew how to squeeze a nickel.
Right.
That got inculcated in me from a very early age. So, listen, I think that we tend to always look at the things that are out of favor and try to figure out when we can buy them. And these are things that we're looking at that we think trends will change eventually, but they're not there yet. I think when you look at energy, for instance, a lot of these energy stocks, some of the major oils, these things are trading at prices that they were trading at in 2009.
Yeah.
They are extraordinarily cheap. And I think it really boils down to when are you going to see something in the oil market that makes these things more valuable. And on that note, by the way, I would just say I think people may be missing something on the shale revolution, whatever you want to call it. I think that we may be winding down there. It may have reached kind of some limits on drilling technology. And we know that the profile of these wells, that they run off pretty quickly once they get up and going. And I wonder if we don't get to some point where the number of rigs continues to fall and eventually you get in a point where the economy, the global economy, is maybe better than people expect,
yep,
you get some kind of surge in oil price. But anyway, there's that. And there's also international versus domestic. Obviously, domestic has led this entire cycle. That doesn't seem to be changing. And by the way, it's not likely to change until the dollar changes. Dollar starts going down, then you'll probably want to be owning some international things. And the same thing with value in general. For whatever reason, value tends to outperform in those weak dollar environments. That's just not where we are right now. But that's the things that we see that are really, really cheap is international, emerging markets, energy, maybe even the financials.
Yep.
That's the things that we look at that are out of favor, and that's where we want to be looking. We haven't done a whole lot there yet.
Yep, gotcha. That makes sense. So I'm curious if one question we like to ask people if there are books that they would recommend that maybe have helped form how they think about the world or investing, but maybe books that you've read that you find yourself coming back to over time or recommending to other people. Is there anything that sort of jumps to mind?
Well, I'm looking at my bookcase here, and I see Fooled by Randomness, which I thought was wonderful.
Yep.
I see Reminiscences of a Stock Operator, which is by Jesse Livermore, which is quite good.
Yep.
And I see The Intelligent Investor, which was probably the first investing book that I ever read. Look, I'm just a traditional guy. I mean, the first book that really got me interested in markets and economy was a book called The Way the World Works by Jude Winnick. Jude was a strange guy in a lot of ways, but he was also a wonderful guy. He was the editorial page editor for the Wall Street Journal back in the 70s and kind of ushered in that supply-side revolution in the early 80s. That was the book that hooked me on markets and economy.
It was called The Way the World Works?
The Way the World Works. I don't even know if it's still in print.
Yeah.
But it was good, and it got me hooked on economics. So I've been studying it ever since.
Yep, great. So the next one's a little more personal, but and you're going down to Key West, so maybe this is part of it. But what are your favorite activities or things to do away from the office?
I do live in South Florida. We're about a mile from the bay, and we do like to get out and fish and snorkel and dive some. But I also, I'll tell you what I did this weekend. This weekend is a pretty microcosm of what I do. I spent a big portion of Saturday in my orchid house working with my orchids. I love orchids, and we live in a place where, thankfully, you don't even need a greenhouse. You just can just hang them in the yard, and they do great. Kind of benign neglect. The less you do, the better they're going to do.
Yeah,
I love orchids. I love plants. I love that kind of thing. So I did that, and then I spent some time, had some people over, and we did barbecue by the pool. That's what we do.
Oh, that's not too bad. Well, if you ever want to invite some of the guys from Hedgeye to a Florida barbecue, we'd be happy to come down.
Well, we'd be happy to have you, but I will say you guys should wait till wintertime because it's pretty darn hot right now.
Yeah, that sounds good. All right, so the last question here is, you know, if you're giving, and I'm sure you probably talk to young people or mentor folks, but if you were to give somebody, you know, just coming out of college some advice in terms of getting into the industry, what would you say to them?
Getting into the industry, oh my goodness. I would say that everybody I know, that young people especially, that want to get in this business, they want to get in this business because they like markets, and they think this thing is all about I'm going to, you know, make the next big call and be a genius and you know, make a bunch of money. It doesn't really work that way. This business, done right, is actually kind of boring. Alpha is made and built out of the unexpected things, and it's very unlikely that you're going to expect them when nobody else does.
Right.
I would also say too that if you're going to get into this business, you better polish your sales skills. The only reason Dean Witter hired me was because I aced their math test, and I remember we did a sales. They did a sales call. You actually had to call headquarters at Dean Witter and make a pitch. And the sooner they hung up on you, the worse you did. I think I lasted 15 seconds. I had no sales skills whatsoever, but they hired me because they thought I was a pretty smart guy.
Right.
Sales is an important part of this business. You got to get out and talk to people, and you got to love what you do.
Yeah.
If you love this, it comes through, and you'll get clients.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Great. Well, thanks a lot, Joe. We really appreciate your time, and hopefully we can get you back on sometime.
I appreciate it, man. Anytime.
Yep. Thanks a lot, Joe. Take care. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Hedgeye in the Arena. Tune in next time, and I'll be back with a new guest. If you'd like to see more of what we offer, visit us online at hedgeye.com. And make sure to follow us on Twitter at Hedgeye. My handle is at HedgeyeDJ. For information about our investing research products and special discounts for first-time subscribers, email our customer service director, Matt Moran, at mmoran@hedgeye.com. mmoran@hedgeye.com. Thanks for tuning in.
Hedgeye Risk Management is a registered investment advisor registered with the state of Connecticut. Hedgeye Risk Management is not a broker-dealer and does not provide investment advice for individuals. This research does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security. This research is presented without regard to individual investment preferences or risk parameters. It is general information and does not constitute specific investment advice. Nothing presented herein should be construed as legal or tax advice. This presentation is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye Risk Management is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual speaking and not necessarily those of Hedgeye, and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye Risk Management's clients and subscribers. In reaching these opinions and conclusions, the individuals expressing those opinions and conclusions and their employees have relied upon research which is based upon sources considered credible and reliable within the industry. Neither Hedgeye Risk Management nor any individual expressing those opinions and conclusions are responsible for the validity or authenticity of the information upon which it has relied.